couple of brief announcements to update your sick list, and you might want to jot these down, and then we'll get into the lesson. Wes told me that they had moved his grandmother into ICU. She's really not doing very well, so keep her in your prayers and keep Wes and his family in your prayers. And also, Marcia said this morning that Brian, in addition to his normal problems, has been having a pretty bad cold this past week, and he's dealing with that as well. And that's why, of course, she was here this morning and Brian wasn't. So keep them in your prayers. Tonight, you may want to turn in your Bibles back to the passage Kenny read, or turn to Romans 1 a few pages over, and that's what we'll be looking at, where we will be focusing. You know that I visited Freehold last Sunday, and correspond, study with some of the folks that are down there. And one of the questions that came up in a Bible class, I thought was a very interesting question. And so one of the things that I taught last Sunday morning was on this subject, and I decided to do a lesson, did it in the Bible class there Sunday morning, and thought I would come back tonight and study this with you in a lesson. It goes very well. You may remember a couple of weeks, a few weeks back, we talked about Acts 17, and we talked about Paul, his sermon on, as it's sometimes called, Mars Hill, or Areopagus, from verse 22. But tonight I want to touch upon this phrase. Kenny read it for us a moment ago. I'm not going to reread the paragraph, but drop down with me again, if you will. When it says in verse 30, depending on your translation, the times of this ignorance, and the King James says God winked at, some translations say God overlooked, a couple of translations I think say God indulged. And the idea is that, very simply, that God did not punish, literally. The times of the ignorance are the actions that were taken because of the ignorance. God didn't punish for that. There was a time when he did not do that, and so he indulged it. But now he commands everyone to repent. The question that grew in the Bible class, and the one that we want to touch upon tonight, is salvation for people, not under New Testament times, because obviously, in New Testament times, God is commanding people to repent. But what about those who lived before the time of the New Testament? What about either those that were not Jews, people that lived after the law of Moses came, but the law of Moses appears, at least in the Bible, to be very confined, pretty much limited to the Middle East. So what about if we were to go back in ancient times and we were to say the Native Americans over here, let's say we talked about, I know there was a flourishing culture in the Mississippian Valley, all up and down the Mississippi River, flourished over 2,000 years ago. So they certainly would have been in existence before the time of Christ. So what about those people? Did God deal with them at all? And what about man, for that matter, before the law of Moses came in 1445? Now, a person might say, what difference does it make? We live in the time of Christ. We live under the law of Christ. Well, I think it does answer a number of things. Plus, there are certain answers to that question that I believe show us and harken back to the whole idea of God being the God the Bible portrays, and having made the world as he has. If you look at this sermon in Acts 17, Paul is really dealing with that. He is talking about man and what man knew. And you may remember in the lesson a few weeks back, I focused on verse 23, that altar to the unknown God, and how Paul said, you ignorantly worship what you don't know, but I'm here to talk to you about that, kind of making a play on words, so to speak, are on the inscription on the altar. Well, it touches upon that whole idea. What did God do? How was man saved? And, for that matter, people struggle with it even today. Let me give you a modern parallel situation. Someone may say, you know, it's one thing to grow up in a Christian society, like ours maybe, or whatever, at least was, But it's one thing to grow up in such a society, especially if you grow up in the church and you've been taught the gospel, you've been exposed to that from the time you were born. That's one thing. But what about the individual that grows up in a society that is not Christian? You know, a Muslim, for example, in a Middle Eastern country that is not exposed, or someone from India. A few years back now it has been. I think it was around 05, 06, right in there. But I happened to contact a young man from India. And he asked me, you know, what I did. I mean, what kind of business I was in and so forth. So I said, I'm a preacher. He didn't really understand the term. So we talked a little bit about it. I said, you know, I preach. I work for a congregation. I preach the gospel. He had no clue what I was talking about. I said, you know, the Bible. What, you know, the story of Jesus. He didn't know who Jesus was. Now, suppose you came from a society and you had never even heard of Jesus. People think about that and struggle with that. And so the idea is, how does God reach such people? And so these, you know, even in our day, it's a pertinent question to ask the question, how was someone saved before there was even a law of Moses, for example? Or how were people who lived outside the scope or the realm of the law of Moses, how were they saved? And does that teach me anything today? And I think the answer to that is yes on both counts. I want you to go with me to the book of Romans. And I generally try to answer this question by going to Romans 1. Because I think that Paul is dealing, and I'm going to do this fairly briefly, and we could get carried away with it and stay here all night, but we're not going to do that. But I want to touch upon a few points and do that very briefly. Things that I believe Paul is making reference to, at least, in Acts 17, at least some ideas there. But at length, when he writes Romans, and you would remember Romans is not written too long after Acts 17. Wes was making this point just the other night at Wendy's. But when he writes Romans, I think he goes further with all of that. So, in Romans 1 and 2, you find it amazing that Paul, now let's start in verse 16, where Paul says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel of Christ, for it is the power of God unto salvation. Now, we wouldn't deny that. And I would try to teach anyone that. If you're going to be saved, you're going to have to be saved by the gospel of Jesus Christ. However, notice as he goes on, and sometimes it's amazing to people, some of the things that he says. It's the power of God to salvation to everyone that believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek. For therein is the righteousness of God revealed from faith to faith, as it is written in Habakkuk 2:4, the just or the righteous shall live by faith. But verse 18 becomes very interesting. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold, you've heard me say this many times, who hold down or suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Notice how he goes on here when he says, because that, and he begins to delineate a number of things. Look at the end of verse 20 when he concludes, so that they are without excuse. Now, when you read that and you understand that Paul is really saying people without the gospel, people without the righteousness of God, or more particularly, those who do not do what is right, are not only wrong, you know, obviously, but they're without excuse. Notice how several times, and for another example, look at chapter 2 and verse 1 when he says, therefore, as he draws a conclusion, thou art inexcusable, O man, whosoever thou art, and he goes on with this. Without excuse. And people find it extraordinary, especially very learned people, when Romans is debated and debated hotly, they find it just extraordinary that Paul would conclude that people who aren't right, by definition of what's in the gospel, are without excuse before God. And some would even point out that Paul seems to make reference to a time when maybe that wasn't so. It wasn't as strict, at least. Well, why would Paul say people are without excuse? I want to suggest to you that in these two chapters, Romans 1 and 2, Paul is talking about all people, and I really believe, and I might be wrong about this, but I really believe that these are principles that apply to all people everywhere at all times. And the same would be true of us today. Now, certainly, if you have the gospel, you have the Bible, you have an advantage because you have at least that which contains the righteousness of God, so it becomes easier for you to know at least what is right. Maybe not easier to do it, but you at least know what it is. But I think Paul is delineating some principles here that are for all people. And so as you look at this, we might ask the question, why are people without excuse? Well, I think he names five things. Five things that really transcend the gospel, transcend New Testament times, and apply to all people at all times. Now, this would be the case, for example, if you were that, maybe that person living in the time of Job that I think occurs before the law of Moses. Or you were one of those who lived in the time of Noah. Or you were one of those that lived, for example, at the time of the Tower of Babel. Times before the law of Moses is the point. Or you were, say, one of those Native Americans from the Mississippian Valley, roughly 2200 B.C., before the gospel had been carried into all the world. These are principles that apply. And thus, God holds man accountable. And because he holds him accountable, he's without excuse if he doesn't reach God. Notice something that Paul says. Go back to verse 18. And if you read very carefully verses 18 through 20, again, the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all unrighteousness and ungodliness of men who hold or suppress the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which may be known of God is manifest, and notice, and you may have heard me point this out before, it is manifest, that is open, made clear, in them. For God has showed it to them. And he gets very particular in verse 20. He says, for the invisible things of God is the idea. The invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, or Godhood, that is what is of God, so that they are without excuse. I find it extremely interesting, and I made this comment down at Freehold. I'll make it here. I doubt very seriously a lot of people, you know, it is their hobby to read and try to stay up with, you know, quantum physics, quantum mechanics, and all of it. But you've no doubt heard, because it's kind of come down into the popular media, you've heard of the God particle, for example. Now, if you read and you understand that, I know there are some here that do understand that, and you get to digging into that, you realize that scientists have been searching for this particle. It is a very, very extremely, and I mean mathematical, it's just extremely rare that this thing would occur, scientists say. But it does, under very rare conditions, occur. It is properly called the Higgs boson particle, but again, popularly, the God particle. Now, why say that? Why even talk about that? Because scientists believed here in the last few weeks, if you kept up with this kind of thing, that one had been proven. Now, you can't see this thing, but the properties of it you can take note of, and so prove that it is there. Why do they get so excited? Because the God particle is that thing, that particle, to which you attribute the ability to create matter. Let's just say it like that. And if there is such a thing, then we don't have to look for a God to create matter, but we look at that thing. But you know, I was reading about this and reading all this study and so forth, and I get very excited because as you read, you realize you guys are really proposing the necessity of God. As man studies and he learns, I'm convinced that God made himself known. Look again at what the Bible is saying here. Manifested himself. He is clearly known by the simplest things. I believe a man can go out and look in nature around him, and he can see the strength and power of an animal or the beauty of a flower, or he can see the intricacies of even a plant, a tree, or certainly the arrangement, the order of the heavens, and know there's a God. But as we get, and I say we, I mean collectively, man gets brighter, smarter, more intelligent, more knowledgeable, etc., etc. At least that's the way man would see himself. And he discovers more and more and more. He uncovers God's stamp on things where all that is created, even to the most minute of minutiae, God is saying, I'm here. I'm evident. And so as man uncovers things, it's not that it is proving there is no God. No, it's doing just the opposite. It's a piling up more and more and more evidence. That's why there is the whole, you know, the so-called intelligent design movement. Because as man understands more and more and more of the design of the product, he sees the designer. And that's an ancient argument for God. Now I want to go off in that. But I say all of that because God is saying it here. That which may be known of God is manifest in them. They are without excuse because God has left His stamp. God has left His evidence. You don't have to have the gospel to observe God in the world around you. You may not know Him. You may not know who He is. But you can recognize that there is something greater than you, more powerful than you, higher than you. There is an order, a divine lawgiver, etc., etc. And by that reason that God has given you, by that reason you can know there must be a God, and thus you begin seeking Him, and you will find Him. Notice as he goes on here in this passage, if you'll keep reading with me, verse 21. Because that when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. I think that's where we are today. I don't think you're just talking about the, you know, the aborigines in the darkest recesses of whatever continent. I think you're talking about modern man as well. We are people whose foolish heart has become darkened. And then notice verse 22. Is this not descriptive of who we are? Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. And what they do in verse 23 is change the glory of an incorruptible God, one that cannot be corrupted, into an image made like unto various animals or even man himself. And so the created becomes worshipped more than the Creator. Now, is that not exactly what we've done? We've worshipped ourselves. We told ourselves we are too intelligent. We know too much for God. We are greater than the biblical concept of God. We're higher than that. It's a new day, and this is outdated. And on and on and on it goes. Man is without excuse. I want to suggest to you that one of the first great reasons for man being without excuse, or one of the first great arguments for God, is that God has made it clear He exists. And so all men everywhere, no matter where they are, no matter how far removed they are from a copy of God's Word, that is, at least as long as it's been in existence, has had the ability to know there is a God and to seek Him. If you think back to what Kenny read in Acts 17, there is there in that passage, as well as many others, Jesus, if you seek, you shall find. But here was the idea of reaching for God, grasping for Him, looking for God. And the language in that sermon in Acts 17 is the idea of someone being blind. They cannot see God, but they know God is there. If you've ever shut your eyes or been in a very dark room and stumbled around, you may know your house and the layout of it. You know that chair is there. You don't want to stub your toe on it. You're feeling around to make sure you can't see the chair, but you know it's there. Well, the same is true of God. I may not be able to see God, but I can know God is there, and I can reach for Him or grasp for Him. And that's exactly what Acts 17 is saying. Now, I want to suggest to you another reason that we know man had the ability to find God. Look in chapter 2. First, I might say, well, God made Himself known to some people. And this is the way the argument generally goes. For example, God made Himself known to the Jews, and God makes Himself known to maybe people in America with all of these churches, you know, on every corner or whatever. But God doesn't make Himself that well known to everyone. Well, consider something for a moment in chapter 2. God is impartial. And after making all of these arguments, Paul makes the point, if you look down in verse 11, There is no respect of persons with God. No partiality with God. Notice verse 12. For as many as have sinned without law, and I think he makes reference to the law of Moses, shall also perish without law, and as many as have sinned in the law shall be judged by the law. What is he saying there? Man is judged according to what man either has or can have. And God is fair in that. If you look from the beginning of the Bible to the end, there has never been a time there was not law. And we talked about that in, you know, last Sunday night's lesson. If we go back to the Garden of Eden and we look at Adam and Eve, they were innocent. They had never sinned. They were like, spiritually speaking, they were like little children. They've never sinned, but there was law. Law to keep, such as be fruitful and multiply. That was a commandment. But dress the garden, keep the garden, take dominion over all the creation of the earth. And then lastly, there's this tree. Don't eat of the fruit of it. There were laws to keep. They were simple. And as I said last Sunday night, they were as simple as you might say to your four-year-old, pick up your toys. You know, that's a very simple law. But it's a commandment you mean for that child to obey. And one of the reasons you do that is because you're teaching that child the necessity of obedience. You're teaching that child the necessity of recognizing authority, etc., etc. So does God. And when we come through the Bible, whether it is Adam, dress the garden and keep it, or Abraham, get out of your country and go into the one I'll show you, or Moses, take this law down to the people and tell them to observe the Sabbath day, or the New Testament, be baptized for forgiveness of your sins, it is all commandments from God. And God is the one in authority demanding obedience to what He says. What God is saying here in chapter 2 is, I'm not partial. I have no respect of persons. All people, all time, everywhere, no matter who they were, they had laws to keep, laws to obey. And I expect them to obey those laws, and I will judge them accordingly. And it is not that one group of people either has law and therefore is subject to it while another group is not, or one group has law and therefore has advantage, but another group doesn't have it, so they're disadvantaged. It's not that. It is that God is saying, I deal with all people where they are, what they have, or at least what they can have. They have the ability to have. Again, we've already seen that within each of us, there is the ability to recognize at least something higher than ourselves, which ought to prompt us to go on a search. Now God is saying, I'm not partial. So, as God says here in this passage, not being impartial, I demand obedience. Now, going directly from that, stay with me in this part of Romans 2 for a moment. Again, verse 13, he begins to say, for not the hearers of the law are just or right before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. So again, it is not how much you have. You know, there was an atheist that, when I had a radio program a number of years ago, and this atheist used to kind of hound me on the radio program. One of the things that he said, he would make the point, you grew up in a Christian family. He assumed I'd actually grown up in the Church of Christ, which wasn't right. But he would always say, you grew up in the Christian family, so you had that advantage. But you can't hold someone else that didn't grow up in such an environment, you can't hold them accountable. Now, he assumed a lot. But again, the idea, if you look at verse 13, it's not the ones that just have it and hear it. You know, the truth is, I grew up, yes, hearing a whole lot about what God wanted, what God demanded, and ignored most of it, you know, and went out and did something completely different. God is not going to accept me on the basis of what I heard. No, God is going to accept me on the basis of what I keep. But you'll notice something else God says here. Look at verses 14 and 15. And I think this is very pertinent, even to our day. When he says, for when the Gentiles, which have not the law, do by nature the things contained in the law, these having not the law are a law unto themselves. And I think that's one of the most abused and misunderstood statements Paul has made. Because a lot of times someone will go to this passage and here's what they conclude. A person is a law unto himself. This was Joseph Fletcher, you know, the whole situation ethics back 30, 40 years ago especially. But this was his problem, his fallacy. As long as you are true to yourself, almost to quote Shakespeare, you know, to thine own self be true. So as long as you are faithful to your own law, your own rules, then you're fine with God. It's almost as much God as saying to Michael, Michael, you decide what you think is right, and that's what we'll make you keep. Well, boy, that'd be great, wouldn't it? I sit down and decide exactly how I felt about everything, and then just be true to that. Now, even being true to what I think is right, my own principles can be difficult to do, but at least it would be in harmony with how I feel about things. God is not saying that. No, God is making the point here that you have a sense within you. Call it instinct. Call it a moral sense. Call it a conscience, if you will, because that is certainly used in this passage. But you have a moral sense that provokes you. All people everywhere, I believe, the Bible is saying, are born with the ability to know certain things are wrong. They can know stealing is wrong. They may be taught differently. They may grow up in a society that honors certain kinds of theft, that rewards, for example, you know, how crafty someone can be to take something away from another. I think of some of the Native American tribes and so forth. But they have to learn that. And they're born with a sense to know, and even in those societies that think it is perfectly all right, legitimate to steal from your enemy, some of those societies would punish theft from your own people more harshly than even we do. So there is a sense that that's wrong. There's a sense among people, a moral sense, a moral conscience, that lying is wrong. That to tell the truth is right. Or that murder is wrong. Or to take someone's spouse away from them is wrong. And on we go. Those are moral laws, and God has given us that sense. We are not merely animals. We're not people that just appeal to our own sense, and we are allowed to be carried away with that, and whatever we decide is right. You know, you go back, and we were watching this old movie the other night. But some of you may be familiar, especially some of you that are older, with the Loeb and Leopold murders, murder of the young boy in Chicago, and this would have been 1924. Now, if you're not familiar with the story, here it is briefly. Two extremely intelligent young men, Loeb and Leopold. They had IQs literally off the chart, especially in the case of Leopold. I mean, for example, we're talking about, you know, kids at the age of 19, one of them, for example, speaking 24 languages, that kind of intelligence. But they were carried away with Nietzsche's philosophy. And Nietzsche's philosophy was of a certain portion of society with the highest IQ. He is a superman. He's one of a group of supermen. And as a superman, he has the right to transcend the little laws of society. And in short, what these two youngsters did was take that philosophy to its end. And basically what they said is, we're smart enough, we're intelligent enough, that anything we decide to do is right. And so for the thrill of it, admittedly, mind you, for the thrill of it, just to know what the experience was like, they kidnapped Leopold's second cousin, 14 years old, and went out and knocked him in the head and killed him. Poured hydrochloric acid on him to try to burn away his remains and attempted to perform the perfect crime, in which they were just about as bumbling and stupid as any two kids could be with that. They were caught and they were sentenced. But here's the point. Is God saying just because you decide you have the right to do something, that you have the right to do it? Of course not. And when we look at Loeb and Leopold killing that young boy, we say, you see, that's where it leads to. But doesn't the same kind of philosophy, isn't that the same philosophy when someone comes along and says, I have a right to be happy. And what makes me happy is to take your wife or your husband away from you. Isn't that the exact same thing? And so what God is saying here is certainly not because someone thinks it's right or feels it's right, is right. No, what God was saying was, I have a law, and there is also a moral sense within man that makes him do certain things that I put in my law, like thou shalt not lie, steal, kill, etc. Look at verse 15. These things, these moral laws at least, show the work of the law written in their hearts, that is their minds, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or are excusing one another. When your conscience is tearing at you, at least at some point in your life, and saying, this thing is wrong, you are expected by God to listen to that and not to deny it. To deny it, go back to chapter 1, verse 18, is to suppress the truth in your unrighteousness. Now, I want to suggest to you there is a third, or at least a fourth reason that God has given to man whereby man can know. I don't believe there, and you can disagree with me if you want. That's fine. But I don't believe there has been any society that is totally exempt, if you will, from any knowledge of God. Yes, there's a young man in India, obviously there was in 2005 or whatever, that had never heard of Jesus. Okay? That is true. But does that mean that he has no knowledge, or there is no knowledge, at least in his society, of God? I know that's not so. In fact, do you realize that in every major culture in the world, God has left for man, has made sure that there is a record of him in every culture? There are numerous things. We could go on and on all night, but I want to at least throw some things out here. I'd like for you to go home and do your own research. You will find it fascinating. But in every major culture around the world, every continent except for Antarctica, there are myths, stories, legends, tales, folklore, whatever you want to call it, a creation story that in many respects, in many different cultures, is eerily similar to the story of Adam and Eve. But not only that, in every major culture, every continent around the world, there is similarly a tale, a story, folklore, and so forth, of the flood. And eerily similar, where many of those stories, many of those legends or myths, have people, sometimes two, sometimes eight, why eight? Building a boat, getting into a boat, putting animals on the boat, and being saved by the care of God from a great flood. It's amazing. But not only that. In every major culture, every continent around the world, there are myths, legends, stories of the Tower of Babel. Now, it varies from culture to culture, but the things that are similar is that at one time all people spoke the same language. And because of something they did to offend a deity, a god, he made them, he confounded, confused them, so they couldn't understand each other. So they spoke different languages, and they had to spread out from each other. Now, don't you find that interesting? I certainly do. If the biblical story of the creation and the flood and the Tower of Babel and so forth are not true, why is it that man has retained a record of that in his culture? And not just one isolated culture here and another isolated culture there, but all of them. I find that amazing. And in fact, if I were a person who were answering the call from within that there must be something higher in me, I think I'd start there. What does my own culture say? What do my people say? What are the things that have been handed down? That's what tradition is. From generation to generation. I would at least start there. God has made sure there is this retained or kept tradition, and it exists all over the world. But finally, is that all there was? Could man stumble around, feeling around for God, but never reaching God, and that's all there was? He knew things were right and things were wrong. He knew there must be someone higher. But there were no Bibles in his day. There wasn't even an Old Testament in the majority of the world. So how did man reach the God? Well, I believe there was direct revelation And I'm going to throw this out to you. You can think about it. And I'll be glad to study this further with anybody that wants to. But, you know, it is interesting when you go back to the Old Testament and a person says, now, when we go back before the law of Moses, do we see God speaking to man? Well, obviously so. God spoke to Adam. We know that. We know that God, by faith, told man to sacrifice animals. He held Cain accountable for what was given by faith, the writer of Hebrews says. We know, for example, if we come ahead in time, that certainly he's speaking to Noah and saying, Noah, build this ark, you know, and telling him all those things. We know he spoke to Abraham. Abraham was in an idolatrous culture, remember? Joshua makes that point. If you look at Joshua 24 and 23 and 24 there, he was in an idolatrous culture. Our fathers, Joshua said, worshipped idols beyond the Euphrates River, but not Abraham. So here was a man that for whatever reason, and one wonders, what is the reason? Did he look around him and see there was a God? Notice, take notice. Did he look within himself and see his own moral conscience telling him not to join in the practices of idolatry that went on around him, even his own family? What was it that made Abraham look for God? Whatever it was, when he found God, God spoke to him. And we know that. And so God says to him, get out of your country, go to where I will show you. Now a person says, well, God is only speaking to Abraham because God has this plan, going to give a law of Moses and eventually going to bring Jesus through that lineage. I can buy that, except for the part of only spoke to Abraham. I want you to turn back into your Old Testament with me to the book of Genesis and go to Genesis 14. When Abraham came to the land of Canaan, he came because God had directly spoken to him. There was no Bible at the time. There was nothing written. Moses, this is a long time before Moses, at least 400 or 500 years. And so there's no written Bible. It is only God speaking to man. Now Abraham came to Canaan and he brought, of course, his nephew Lot with him. And if you remember the story here, the kings, basically the kings from the area, the land from where Abraham had come, the land of Shinar and so forth, they come and in this they take Lot with them. They capture him. Abraham goes after him. And if you look down about verse 13, you can see Abram, as he's called at this time, going and actually rescuing Lot. Now he comes back. And he's brought back with him not only his nephew, but he's brought back a lot of material goods. Look at verse 16. He brought back all the goods. He brought again his brother Lot, his goods and the women also, and so forth. He brought back a number of things. And then a very interesting story. He meets Melchizedek. And when he meets Melchizedek, in verse 18, it tells you that Melchizedek is the king of Salem. That would be Jebusalem, or the forerunner, at least the place that would eventually be Jerusalem. And in short, Melchizedek blesses Abraham, and Abraham, verse 20, if you look at it, to the end of verse 20, pays tithes to Melchizedek because he is, look at the end of verse 18, the priest of the Most High God. Now, how does that happen? Melchizedek is not related to Abraham. Melchizedek is a Canaanite. Abraham is from the land of Ur of the Chaldees. Abraham is visiting in his land. There is no Bible that Melchizedek could have gone to and learned about God. How does Melchizedek know God? How does he know him so intimately that he becomes a priest of the Most High God? And does that suggest that if a person reaches for God, looks for God in this day and time, if he were doing that, that like God speaks to Abraham directly. You can look over at chapter 15 and see an example of that, where God comes and speaks to Abraham, but that he might also speak to a Melchizedek or someone else. And I want to suggest to you, if he can do it to one, he can do it to another. What we're left with is to say this. Would we say that God really impartially advantaged some people, making provision for them, reaching out to them, a Melchizedek even, an Abraham, and thus allow them to be saved while looking the world over and saying, the rest of you, I don't want it. That's Calvinism. Or would we say that anyone in this day who sought God would be sought out by God? And I would think that really the example in the Bible would tend toward that. It's something to think about anyway. It goes with the story. A lot of you have asked me about that Epimenides story from a couple of weeks ago. Go back, that sermon is online. Go back and revisit that, and then compare that with some of what we're saying tonight. If you've got questions, I'd be glad to study that with you. If you're here tonight and you're not a Christian, you believe in God. And really what the Bible is teaching us, and in our day and in our land, our situation tonight, that is very easy, very simple for us. We know that God exists, and we know how to find God, how to reach Him. We have His Word, we have His revelation. If you believe in it, and you would confess that Jesus is the Son of God, and you would repent, change your life, live your life according to what God says, rather than your own feelings, your own ideas,